BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Just to say that for rights reasons, the music in the original radio broadcast has been removed for this podcast. Good afternoon. Welcome to Weekend Woman's Hour with me, Anita Rani. In the next hour, a sparkly new musical has just opened in London's West End, The Devil Wears Prada, and we're joined by its three leading ladies. We discuss the recommendations from a new report about the prevention and consequences of premature or preterm birth and talk to a mother about her experience and the impact when her baby, born prematurely, died. This is a gentle signpost to say that we will be hearing a story that some of you may find upsetting. We have former head teacher Evelyn Ford, who's written a manifesto to tackle racism when it comes to leadership positions in education. And we go to the Himalayas, where the author and TV presenter Giovanna Fletcher has been leading an arduous trek.
For me, it feels like I come along and I spend every day, you know, kind of telling my kids, we've got to do this and being the one in charge. Whereas I come on these and there's people that know what they're doing. I don't need to make any decisions. I just need to walk, and talk. And it's such a beautiful thing because I don't think any of us actually get that chance to do that. So, yeah, we just literally get our heads down, walk, take in the view and talk about a lot of things.
Lots to get through. So grab a cup of whatever you fancy and settle in for the next hour. Now, this week, Woman's Hour has broadcast a series called Forgotten Children, which looks at the impact on families when one or both parents is sentenced to prison. The government estimates that nearly 200,000 children are affected by parental imprisonment. It's an estimate because there is no centralised register of children whose parents are in prison. On Monday, our reporter Jo Morris spoke to Kerry Wright, who was 17 and living in Spain with her parents, when British police knocked on the door and arrested both of them. Kerry has chosen not to disclose her parents' crimes. They were both sentenced to prison in the UK, and Kerry had to abandon her studies at an international school in Spain and return to England with no idea of how to support herself. She kept her situation secret, sleeping on friends' sofas, until she decided to confide in someone.
I remember telling my friend about it, and she said, oh, come and stay with me. I then got a phone call from her mum saying that she didn't want me there because she didn't want my friend to get involved. She didn't want to get involved in any of this. And that's when I was like, oh, okay. So I remember being gutted. Like, I was like, oh, no, it's no big deal, no biggie. And then on the inside, I was just like, I didn't expect that from her. I felt, I guess, that I was being blamed for my parents, for what they've done, even though I had nothing to do with it, obviously. I was a child. People don't want to be associated with me now. And like, I noticed as well, so when all the articles started coming out...
In the press, sorry.
That's when, you know, friends started to drop off. You know, you don't hear from them anymore. And that kind of added to the loneliness because you're like, who can I rely on?
So when you were back in the southeast, you were sofa surfing. Did anyone professional offer you any help anywhere? Anyone signpost you or anything?
No one did. The police didn't. The council didn't. An education.
Did the police know you were there?
Yeah. And they knew I wasn't with family or anything. There was nothing, there was no support.
That was Kerry Wright talking to Jo Morris. Then on Tuesday's programme, Nuala spoke to Sarah Burrows, founder of Children Heard and Seen, a charity supporting children and families with parents or partners serving prison sentences. She was also joined by Lucy Baldwin, research fellow at Durham University and a criminal justice consultant. Both Sarah and Lucy believe that without a systematic approach to identifying children whose parents are in prison, it's impossible to give them the help they need. But identification is not enough on its own, as Lucy explained to Nuala.
You know, lots of children who experience parental imprisonment suffer in many different ways. And I think identifying those children is half of the problem. But, you know, tailoring support for children is the other half.
And what sort of support?
The kind of support that Sarah's organisation offers, like psychological, educational, emotional, practical, physical, accommodation. It covers the gamut of what children need.
Because I'm mindful that as part of its manifesto in June, the current Labour government pledged that the children of those who are imprisoned are at far greater risk of being drawn into crime than their peers. We will ensure that young people are identified, back to that word again, I might use kind of discovered, might be a better word, and offered support to break the cycle. I mean, what does that need to look like? And why is there that emphasis, you think, on breaking the cycle?
I think the emphasis is almost on breaking the cycle is almost incorrectly identifying the point, because we do know that children who have a parent in prison have an increased risk, but it's really impossible to isolate that risk because of, you know, and attune that to the fact that the parent has gone to prison, because people who go to prison usually come from disadvantaged communities with lots of trauma in the background, lots of missed opportunities in terms of drug and alcohol support, mental health, poverty, accommodation, and the children are growing up in that same environment. So you can't really isolate the one factor
that they have a parent in prison
as being the single most important factor as to why they might go to prison in the future. You can't have effective criminal justice without effective social justice, and it's the social environment that the children are living in that places them at risk.
Sarah, who do you think, which minister or which department should be ensuring that part of that pledge, at least, I don't know whether you agree with the whole pledge of the current Labour government, but to find out that they are identified, and then they also talk about breaking that cycle of not being drawn into crime?
I think it's a Department of Education. I don't think it sits under the Ministry of Justice. It isn't about children having family ties and reducing the offending of the person in prison. This is about children and children themselves. Children have to be the heart of it all, and it is a safeguarding risk why this continues.
Department of Education says, Sarah, Lucy, what say you?
I agree that the Department of Education need to be involved, but I think it's broader than that. I actually think that, you know, it needs to be a cross-party commitment and a multi-agency response with ministers from social care, from education, and from just a community background to recognise some of the challenges that children face. And I think in terms of identification, the Ministry of Justice do have a responsibility, because when people go to court, there is a missed opportunity there for when somebody's been sentenced to identify the children. I think every person should have, every parent who is in court should have something called a PSR, a pre-sentence report, which is written by the probation service. And in that probation report, it should identify what the impact of a parental imprisonment sentence would be, where the children are, how old they are, who will be caring for them, and what their needs are.
Lucy Baldwin and Sarah Burrows. And then on Wednesday, we heard Jo Morris visit Nan, not her real name. She took in her five grandchildren into her two-bedroom house when her daughter was in prison for 2 years.
So you're making some chicken wraps there?
Yes.
What sort of things did you use to make the grandkids?
Well, they love curries. They love curry. So I'd always do them a curry. Four lads and a girl, you know, and it's like, they loved the food, but it was just the amount and then the pots.
The pots. The washing up.
Yeah. Yeah. I should have got the kitchen's not big enough for a dishwasher, do you know what I mean? So I think I mollycoddled them a little too much though as well. Like, grandparents are there, like, for all the good little bits. Oh, we've got nanas, we're going to get treats, blah, blah, blah. So it was like, then I was like, I was nana, but then I was the role of mum. And it was like trying to balance that. Was difficult, was really difficult.
What was the emotional and the psychological impact on the grandchildren, do you think, of the parents being in prison?
Oh God, it was massive, really. You know, it, a couple of them, like, didn't speak as much, you know, so they were very, very quiet. And I did used to remind them all, you know, like, if one was having a go at the other, and I'd say, like, come on, I said, you know, they're going through exactly what you're going through, so how bad you feel, they'll feel as bad as you. I mean, most of it went by in a blur, because it was just, it was so full on. There was always something to do. There was never a minute, do you know what I mean? So it just kind of, like, flowed until lockdown. And that was tough as well, the lockdown, you know, having them all here. And they was trapped in the house with the thoughts, basically.
Did they talk to you about how they were feeling? Did they talk to any?
No. It was strange that, you know, like, they needed counselling. We tried to get it for the older ones. A thing that I think the kids didn't want to talk about it because they were scared of their emotions that had come with it.
Do you think they were scared to tell you how they were feeling?
They might have been. They might have thought, well, if I tell my nan might start crying, it might really upset her. They've always been really good kids. And they really still are. Honestly, you wouldn't believe it. They're absolutely so good children. And you can see how much it's affected them. Now, they was also really close, you know, the children. And then they've all got to process how they're feeling themselves, you know, and it kind of, it fractured, you know, because they was all internally having to process and deal with what was going on. And it just kind of, like, broke them. You know, they was never the same after that. Never.
That was Jo Morris talking to Nan. On Thursday, Jo talked to a mum, Emily, not her real name, about how her children reacted when their father was sent to prison for violent crimes committed against Emily.
My youngest kept saying to me, you need to find me a new dad. Like, I need a dad. Like, oh, what about this person? And because she just needed, like, she saw all her friends having these family, like, the weekends were the worst because people would go out and do activities as a family and we weren't. I think she said to me, we're just broken, aren't we? And it was so hard because obviously I felt that that was my fault. And for her to say that, like, they noticed that we were different and we weren't normal. Like, they'd seen families that had split up before, but they'd still see their dad, whereas they had no contact. So it was almost like he died, but he hadn't. So they were grieving a loss, but he was still there. So it was a really kind of complex, like, I don't know how you understand that. So I can't imagine how a child would understand that. Equally, he was trying to hurt me, and that was why he was away. And all of their friends have got these great families that they just wanted to have. And also, it affected us financially. He was the main earner. I was working part-time, and then eventually I couldn't work because I came ill, and then we didn't have any money, and all of their friends were going and doing stuff, and we used to have that life. We used to go on holiday. We used to do things. And then all of a sudden, we couldn't do anything. Eventually, I did managed to get back to work, but it was still like we're living on one income. Like, I'd fled, so we had nothing. So we had no sofa, no bed, no tea. Like, we had to start again with absolutely nothing. Like, we live in quite a privileged area. I don't know anyone who's got a parent in prison. I've never known anyone go to prison. It is looked down upon. Like, we were looked down upon at school in the playground. My youngest one, she didn't get invited to people's houses. And I don't know if that's because of he was in prison, but the others did beforehand. Like, I hated doing the school pickup. It was like, I didn't want anyone to speak to me, but then I equally didn't want to stand on my own because I felt everyone was judging me. Because they didn't know why he was in prison. And I remember a dad a few years later, and he said to me, oh, I thought he went to prison for fraud or burglary. And I was like, no, we were the victims.
Emily talking to Jo Morris about the stigma she faced when her now ex-husband was imprisoned for domestic violence. Well, we had a huge response from you all week expressing your admiration for Kerry, Nan and Emily and your shock at the lack of provision for families like theirs. Comments like, very moving but also very reflective about an extraordinary experience to happen to a 17-year-old and so little or no support given. I'm sorry it happened to you, but well done for telling your story. And another listener said, what an amazingly beautiful granny. She brought me to tears with her unconditional love and sacrifice through her outside family sentence. And in response to Emily's story, Emma got in touch to say, thank you for highlighting the important issue of the impact of parental imprisonment from a child-led perspective. Too many focus on the prisoner and not those left behind and damaged by the criminal justice system. My children have been damaged by their dad serving a 7-year sentence. They suffer from separation anxiety, and it's been difficult for me to continue working full-time in a job I love, as I've had to focus on my children. While the Department of Education is responsible for protecting vulnerable children, we asked them to join us for Friday's programme, but they didn't have a minister or spokesperson available. They did, however, give us a statement saying growing up with a parent in prison can have a devastating impact on a child's life opportunities. We have taken measures to better identify and support these children. We have published the first official statistics of the number of children with a parent in prison to better understand the scale of this challenge. We're also breaking down barriers to opportunity, taking action to prevent more women and mothers from getting caught up in crime in the first place. And you can catch up with all of the Woman's Hour Forgotten Children series, which was broadcast over this last week, by going to BBC Sounds. Next, to London's West End. The musical lovers amongst you will be out of your seats clapping with glee as a new show has just opened, The Devil Wears Prada. The iconic film starring Meryl Streep, Anne Hathaway and Emily Blunt was released 18 years ago, and now a new musical adaptation, lyrics contributed by the American musician Shaina Taub and music by Elton John, is hitting the West End. This week, I was joined by the three leading ladies in the show, Vanessa Williams, Georgie Buckland and Amy Di Bartolomeo. I began by asking Georgie, in case you haven't seen the film, what the storyline is.
So the story follows Andy Sachs, our protagonist, who I'm lucky enough to play in the musical, who gets a job at Runway magazine and meets Emily Blunt's character, Emily, played by Amy, who is the first assistant to Miranda Priestley, played by Vanessa Williams. And Andy kind of works her way up at Runway and changes her lifestyle and goes to Paris, and lots of things happen. I won't spoil too much, but it's about a girl who loses herself briefly to get ahead career-wise, and in the end realises that the only thing she needed to do was stick to her own integrity and what she truly wanted out of life.
But she gets some amazing outfit changes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, she does. Vanessa, you play Miranda Priestley, the original role played by Meryl Streep, the right. boss from hell. Mm-hmm. Was this a no-brainer when you got the call?
I loved the idea to play it. There was another production that had happened. So I was, but Jerry Mitchell, who is our director, choreographer, said, listen, I'm coming to you. Don't read any critics' reviews of the last production. I'm taking over. Trust me, I'm going to come back to you with an offer. But you're my first choice. So I knew that Jerry had a huge vision, and I trusted Jerry's vision that he would shepherd the show into what you saw last night. Mm. So, yeah, honestly, I was a little, some trepidation at first, just because it is theater, mm. and it's all about collaboration and creators and vision and budget and what they have in mind. So, but I am so happy where we are. It's a brilliant group of people that have been putting this whole piece together, and I'm in definitely great hands.
Yes, and you are magnificent on the stage. And also, when your name was released as the person who yeah. would be playing this role, we were all delighted. You know, and what a gift. Is it a gift? You know, can I reveal your age? Am I allowed
sure,
to?
Sure, I'm 61.
61.
Yeah.
You know, and this, you know, starring in the West End. Mm-hmm. Were you expecting something like this to turn up? Is this, you know, a wonderful thing to have happened right now?
Well, I really enjoyed it because I was supposed to make my West End debut in 2020 in City of Angels at the Garrick. So we had already gone through all of our rehearsals. We were in previews, and then the whole world shut down. So this was an opportunity to come back and actually make it happen. So I'm happy to be back in the West End theater scene, happy to work with all these brilliant people that surround me every day and do a role that is a lot of fun. And I've been lucky to be able to play some formidable women in
yes.
the past.
Yes, including Wilhelmina Slater in Ugly Betty. Similar role in some ways.
Yeah. Well, Wilhelmina never got a chance to be editor-in-chief. That was her for 4 years. She tried really hard and did anything she could possible to get to that position. But Miranda, it's her. She's at the helm.
Amy, you get to play Emily. She is hilarious. Not always the nicest to Andy. What's it like to play comedy? Is the first time you're playing comedy?
Yeah, I've been desperate to play it. I just couldn't get seen. Real talk. I really wanted to
play or even audition for a comedy role, and I just couldn't get in for one. And when I saw this, I was like, let's go.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I think
she's too beautiful to be funny.
No. I think people put you, it's all about breaking out of your boxes, isn't it? I think I was, oh God, I'm being really honest. I think I was put in a, she can riff, she can, you know, she's, oh, she dances. And I'm like, no, but I do so much more. Please let me show you. And this was finally, I say it all the time, I'm really grateful for this team because they're the people that finally took a chance on me and said, no, she can do it.
Yeah.
And I've been having the best time ever since.
First of all, we welcome pure honesty at Woman's Hour.
Great.
And also, you're right, it only takes one person to give you that break. You are so funny.
Thank you.
Talking of the person to give you a break, your very first, you've only graduated 5 minutes ago, Georgie, and now you're starring in a huge West End musical.
Yeah, it kind of happened overnight for me. I was the last person to be cast. Very last minute. I mean, they had to search for months to cast this part, and Jerry was very honest and said he couldn't find anyone to play her. And I came in, I was on tour at the time. I remember my first audition, I dropped my music all over the floor and was swearing and was a mess, like an absolute mess. And I had to get back to Nottingham. That's where I was on tour at the time. And he just saw something in me. He said, I like that girl. I remember that girl.
Star quality. You are brilliant. Well, all three
what can
of
I
you.
Say?
Are just, yeah, 3 weeks in. I mean, it's wonderful. We need to talk about the fashion because exquisite. I'm thinking particularly of the ballroom scene. It's magnificent. There's so much in it. Anyone who's into musicals, this is the, you know, it's just it's an instant classic. It is a piece of the eyes.
It is.
Oh, God, yeah. But all I kept thinking about is they have to wear high heels on stage all the time. Yeah. Is that difficult?
Yes. These two, I feel, are a natural. I am not. I spent a lot of time in my room. Not a lot of people know this. Wearing heels, walking up and down, going, I need to look good. But I can get away with it because she's not supposed to be so natural at it. So,
but the costumes are exquisite. What does it feel like putting those on every single night?
Well, I was lucky because I got a chance to create a majority of my things. I worked with a dear friend of mine who's a designer. The name of her line is Pamela Rowland. So I did a lot of my stuff with Greg Barnes, who's our costume designer. We came up with fabrics and shapes and did mood boards and all that stuff. Yeah. So I would say 70% of my things are Pamela. And then I do wear some Tom Ford, some Dior, some Prada that are store-bought. Store-bought.
Yeah.
It's hardly store-bought. Yeah. But yeah. So it's wonderful.
And yeah.
That's what people are going to come to see as well.
Yeah. Couldn't believe it. An Instagram message from Greg Barnes, watched the workshop we did and was like, I'd like to talk to you as soon as possible. And I remember turning it to my boyfriend Lawrence and being like, I can't believe this is happening. And so we zoomed straight away. And the first thing Greg said to me was, I want you to feel amazing. What do you want?
Yeah.
I want you to feel comfortable. How do you see her? How do you envision her? Do you mind wearing stilettos? And I said, Greg, there's only one choice. We have to do stilettos.
You please do, yeah.
Emily has to be, the main thing, my thing was, she has to be so on trend, so before the trend or straight off the runway. She spends all of her money on her fashion. I have to be in stilettos. I want to be uncomfortable, so I had everything taken in as tight as possible. So my posture, I just think she would really care about how she looks.
Yeah, you embody her.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
And it helps so much when it comes to the character because you can feel any kind of way.
Vanessa Williams, Georgie Buckland and Amy D. Bartolomeo and The Devil Wears Prada is at London's Dominion Theatre. And if you were wondering, Vanessa Williams is breathtakingly beautiful in real life. Now, TV presenter and author Giovanna Fletcher has been in the Himalayas this week on a 4-day trek, raising awareness for Copper Feel, the breast cancer charity, and helping to guide over 120 supporters through the mountain range. Amongst those lacing up their hiking boots and acting as group leaders with her were Dragon's Den entrepreneur Sarah Davis, TV presenter Emmy Willis, and Paralympian Erin Kennedy. Nuala spoke to Giovanna before they set off and asked her how everyone was feeling about the trek ahead.
feel like everyone comes with different things that they're apprehensive about, different fears, whether that's whether they're physically going to be able to do it, mentally, emotionally, where they're going to go for a wee, you know, all those things that they're in your mind. And, you know, and I've been doing this for a long time now. This is my 13th trek.
So you are a proper cheerleader for the rest that are coming. Along with you. Give us a few more details about what's ahead.
We've got three more days of trekking ahead. Lots of very steep mountains, and what's incredible is today that we're walking and across the valley we can see one of the mountains that we're going up tomorrow, and it looks absolutely stunning. But for a lot of us, we're sort of like, oh my gosh, that looks incredible, but also that is going to be hard. But what I love about the treks, and I think this is something that Copperfield do so incredibly, is I always say, like, I don't care how fast people go. I don't want you to get to the finish straight away. It's all about being together as a group and getting each other through. And because of that, there's always such an amazing atmosphere.
But 120 supporters, have I got that right on the trek?
Yeah, 120.
Is it like herding cats, or is it more like regimented military precision?
One thing I love, I think it's a mixture of the two. The one thing I love about these treks is that for me, it feels like I come along and I spend every day, you know, kind of telling my kids we've got to do this and being the one in charge. Whereas I come on these and there's people that know what they're doing. I don't need to make any decisions. I just need to walk. Just need to walk and talk. And it's such a beautiful thing, because I don't think any of us actually get that chance to do that. So yeah, we just literally get our heads down, walk, take in the view and talk about a lot of things. Because obviously we've got 120 trekkers. A lot of people here have had a breast cancer diagnosis, or someone close to them has, or they might be here because they are just hitting a certain milestone age-wise, or something's happened in their life and they just want to challenge themselves. So there's so much that everyone comes with. Everyone has a story, whether it's cancer related or not. Everyone comes with something, and there's something about walking with a bunch of strangers that just lets all that out. You don't have to worry about how someone's going to perceive something, or how a family member might take you feeling about thinking about a certain thing in some way. You just talk, and because of that, it's just brilliant. It's a lovely place to be.
And what's your story?
I met Chris, the founder of Copperfield, 10 years ago, and I knew as soon as I met her that I would do anything for her. But two of my aunts have had breast cancer, and someone who was very close to me when I was younger also had breast cancer. And I remember seeing her in a hospice, and at the time she was in her 60s. And I remember thinking, when I met Chris, who, you know, when I met her, she had been diagnosed when she was 23. And so my mind went instantly to Molly and her in that hospice. And I just thought, I can't believe that I felt like my whole life had been lied to in terms of breast cancer. I assumed that it was something that older women got, and that it was only women, and that it was only a lump. That's not the case at all. You can get breast cancer at any age. Men get diagnosed with breast cancer. 400 men a year in the UK get diagnosed with breast cancer. It's not just a lump. It's thickening of the tissue. It's dimpling. It's rashes. It's inverted nipple. It's nipple discharge. Anything that changes. And it's also important to know that when people are checking, that you've got to go up to your collarbone and under your armpit as well. So it's not just what you perceive to be your boob or your chest. And I think knowing the signs and symptoms, it can literally save so many lives. And if you're on top of it, and if you're checking and you find something and you go to the doctor, if it's something that's not your normal, it can literally be the difference between survival and not. Mm. You know, so knowing your body is just such an important thing to do. So I've been doing these treks now for 7 years, and we can really easily feel like, well, I've said it now and everyone's heard it. But that's not the case at all. We need to keep banging the drum, because we don't know if someone hears the message today and goes, oh, actually, maybe I should go to the doctor about that little thing that's been niggling me. That's a bit embarrassing, but actually maybe I should just put my big old knickers on and just go out there. Or whether they hear it and go, in 10 years time, they might be like, oh, that's not my normal. I know I should go to the doctor. So I think it's something that we have to keep talking about and reminding people of, because we can't just think, well, everyone knows now, so let's stop. I think it's really important.
And Chris Helenga, who was the founder of Copperfield, and really who was advocating for all those things that you just talked about, when you're checking your breasts and collarbone and under the armpits. Mm-hmm. She so sadly passed away in May this year. I mean, an amazing life, really, in what she achieved, I think, in her life, and also in her death, being so open about it. What's your fondest memory of her?
I truly feel like, and I think a lot of people that had Chris in their lives felt that Chris was sent to just do everything that she did. She achieved so much in her lifetime. But my fondest memories of her are all the cold swims that we used to have in Cornwall. And I always used to have that thing of Chris would always go first. And it was one of those things where she's done it, so I just have to. But there was one point in Newquay Harbour where we got in and had a little swim around. It was absolutely freezing. But then there was a seal and it was just the most magical thing. And it didn't always go right. You know, there was another time where she managed to talk us into having inflatables on our cold water swim. And again, she got in first, then I got in. But my float just wanted to float off. So I had a little panic where I had to just definitely get off the float and just swim back. But I did think that was maybe me going off into the sea somewhere. But yeah, I feel so honoured to know that Chris is and was. I find past tense such a difficult thing to you know, she remains such a massive part of my life, and these treks feel like such a gift. So the fact that I'm able to continue spreading her message, that, you know, that we're able to help Copperfield, which is her baby, to just get more and more people body aware so that they too can, you know, live long lives. And the fact that Chris lived with cancer for 15 years, you know, and she really did live.
She did.
Like, I remember at her funeral, you know, which for anyone that doesn't know, she had a living funeral. When things started, you know, she was having more cancer activity in her brain, she decided to have a living funeral. And it was the most bizarre, beautiful thing ever. And her friend stood up at the start of it, and she was like, you know, none of us know what this is. We don't know how we're meant to feel, so just ride it. And it was such a celebration of life. Yes, there were tears, obviously, but there was so much laughter and euphoria and that feeling of how wonderful it is to be alive. So, you know, that is certainly something that I take with me, and I hope that we bring along to the treks.
Giovanna Fletcher there, and the group successfully completed the trek this morning. Well done, gang. Still to come on the programme, music from a new musical exploring the life of Maria Anna Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's lesser known sister, also known as Nan. And remember, you can enjoy Woman's Hour any hour of the day. If you can't join us live at 10 a.m. during the week, all you need to do is subscribe to the daily podcast. It's free on BBC Sounds. Now, the evidence is unequivocal. The government's target to reduce the rates of preterm births from 8% to 6% by 2025 will not be met. That's the finding from a new report by the House of Lords Preterm Birth Committee published this week. Preterm birth is the single biggest cause of neonatal mortality in the UK. This report is the end result of an inquiry looking into how the statistic can be improved in England. Among the recommendations, the report calls on the government to put greater focus on the needs of parents, as well as develop the maternity and neonatal workforce. I was joined this week by Nadia Leake, who gave evidence to the committee of her experience. She gave birth to twins preterm and has written a book called Surviving Prematurity. You may find some of the details distressing. I began by asking Nadia why she felt she wanted to share her story.
As soon as Harrison was born, and his brother Rafe, who sadly died at 3 weeks old, we knew that the circumstances we were in were so far from what we wanted. We'd been desperate for our family. Our twins were the product of the fifth attempt of IVF, and we had been trying for so long. So when we arrived at the hospital, unfortunately at 23 weeks pregnant, to be told that it was too early, I was fully dilated with bulging membranes. I didn't really know what that meant at the time, but I understood that I was about to deliver, it was imminent, and there's nothing they could do. So not only were we in a situation where these babies we'd longed for were set to be born and then die, we were told we could hold them in our arms and they could take their last breaths with us. We then got to the point where the care team there said, actually, let's give this a go. We will try to intubate these babies, which is to insert the breathing tube to help them survive.
Where were you?
So we were at the wonderful Barnet and Chase Hospital, who saved our children. And again, this story meanders a bit in that we live in the northeast of England.
Yeah.
I'd come to Hertfordshire for family celebration at 22 weeks pregnant, thinking what could go wrong. And on the way home, this is why we ended up at Barnet and Chase, on the approach to the motorway, I said to my husband, I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable, let me use the services. And there was bright red blood evident. So that's what led us into the nearest hospital, which was Barnet and Chase. And this night of absolute terror where we stayed overnight. Had the boys delivered at any point from then on, they would have been, that would have been their last few hours alive. So the journey continues in that they decided to save the children. We were then transferred, and this separation that happened so quickly. I delivered the boys at about 6 p.m. By midnight, they were transferred to Queen Charlotte's in Hammersmith, a fantastic hospital there and unit there. But I wasn't taken to, well, we couldn't leave to go to Queen Charlotte's until the following afternoon. So I delivered our children, who we were told were going to die. They saved them. They moved. It was the right thing for them to be moved to a unit that could support them and stabilise them. But I didn't see my children again until the following afternoon.
How was that experience?
The emptiness left in you when your child is literally inside you 1 minute and gone the next. I slept because I'd been awake for 24, 30 hours at that stage, but it was fitful. And I was up and dressed by about 6 a.m. the next morning, desperate to get out and go and find my babies. They were across London.
When did you get to see them?
It was about 2 p.m. the next day. We went to the hospital where they spent most of their time at that point. Rafe died in Queen Charlotte's at 3 weeks old, and our journey continued with Harrison. And the separation, so because we were actually in London when we live in the northeast, they managed to find us some accommodation, which very rare to have accommodation so near your baby. So that was life-saving for us all, that we could actually be with him as much as possible. That is not the case for so many families. And this is what has brought me to continue to advocate and campaign for families who need that additional support to be with their families. Mm. If you have other children at home, now these were our first children.
Yeah.
So I could spend all the time I wanted to with Harrison and Rafe. But there are so many barriers to keeping families together. And this is what this work is about. And it was, you know, my heart swelled when I saw in the report talking about accommodation, talking about family integrated care and keeping families together.
So tell me what you think could have been done differently for you and what you spoke about.
Yeah. So because, and this is where my real understanding of how different other families' experiences comes from. Mm. So we had our babies in London. We stayed in London for about 10 weeks and then transferred back up to the northeast once Harrison was well enough. And what I saw there was that the difference in care was around the environment. It was around the staff ethos in how they would support families to be together. So in London, through sheer luck, we had accommodation near our family. We had a department who included us in all care decisions, who very much enabled us to be parents and have those moments of intimacy and love and bonding and those firsts that are just so precious to pick your baby up. And they really supported that and enabled that for us. When we moved to the second hospital back in the northeast, they were very much practicing a less evolved model of care called family-centered care. And at that stage, our role in our baby's care and development was lessened a little bit just through the model of care. So I'll give you an example. Hmm. Unfortunately, Harrison's first bath was in this second hospital. And at the time, the nurse says, well, I'll show you how to bathe your baby. And the nurse bathed our baby while we watched and took a video of it. And looking back, you're so disempowered when you're in any hospital environment. You are beholden to the people who are looking after you. So we watched and we enjoyed it at the time. But looking back, that was our baby's first bath and I did not touch him. Mm. These are the small things that now there's been so much education, so many initiatives now to think about first for families, that first bottle, that nappy change, the things you take for granted at home that unfortunately in a care situation, and this could be months worth, we were in hospital for over 4 months, where those things might not happen and you can't get them back. And in the case where your baby dies, it's lost forever.
Yeah, it's crucial. You're grieving one child and then you have this sort of desperate situation where you don't know what's happening with Harrison, and you just have to go with what the professionals around you are telling you, right?
Absolutely.
Because you don't know any what's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. And I will say, I never questioned the medical care.
Yeah, of course.
We were looked after so well. It was the things that make you a family that were taken away on occasion. And those are the things for me that led to the long-term mental health concerns, PTSD even. When Harrison came home, I would pick him up in the night, as you would do to feed your baby. But I could see his dead brother's face when I was holding Harrison.
And were you given support?
The understanding of the impact of a neonatal stay, it's getting there. But I would say most healthcare professionals in the community don't understand what you've been through, and therefore the support that's offered is often not what you need. So I did go to my GP and I said, I'm not okay. And I was offered bereavement support, but that wasn't the problem.
I've got to ask about your boy, Harrison. How is he now?
Harrison is a 12-year-old boy doing 12-year-old boy things. He is absolutely wonderful. Just back to the prematurity, he is autistic, he has ADHD, and these are the things that are at higher risk for babies born preterm, especially early preterm. But he is smashing life, and he's well-liked at school. His teachers are extremely proud of his progress and how he's doing. And as parents, Martin and I could not be more proud of that boy. He's beautiful, bubbly, and just a joy to be around.
Nadia Leake there. And if you've been affected by anything you've heard in this discussion, you can find help and resource links on the BBC Action Line website. A Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said, while change will not happen overnight, we are working urgently to address stark health inequalities and ensure all women and babies, regardless of background, receive safe, personalised and compassionate care. We have committed to training thousands more midwives, and we will tackle wider social determinants of ill health, which increase the risk of preterm birth, by shifting the focus from treatment to prevention as part of our 10-year health plan. An NHS spokesperson said, the NHS is committed to ensuring all women and babies receive high quality care before, during and after their pregnancy. And while the health service has made improvements to maternity services in England over the last decade, we know further action is needed. We're increasing the number of midwives and obstetricians, and our 3-year delivery plan for maternity and neonatal services, which is supporting midwives and doctors to reduce the number of babies born early and provide the best care when preterm birth cannot be prevented. Now to a book that the author has said might not be your regular book about education. Evelyn Ford was the first black female president of the Association of School and College Leaders, the trade union and professional organisation. Evelyn has written her story, a leadership manifesto to share her journey through the education system, including her experiences of racism in her career, some of which are talked about during the conversation. Just 1% of head teachers in state schools in England are black. Evelyn argues that systemic racism persists in education and that action is needed to address the issue. Evelyn's accomplishments include an MBE for services to education, and she was named Times Educational Supplement Head Teacher of the Year in 2020. Last year, she decided to step down from her role as a secondary head in a state school. Nuala talked to Evelyn Ford earlier this week and began by asking her why this is a book that everyone might not be ready to read.
I just think race can make people feel uncomfortable. And my experiences were pretty horrific. And I just think that some people may not want to hear that. But that was the main reason why I wrote it, because we really need to make a difference on the leadership landscape in education.
Tell me a little bit then about your experiences or the challenges that you faced.
Yeah. So if I can just give you some context.
Please.
I left school with no qualifications at a time when it was quite easy to jump the fence, right?
And jump the fence, you mean not attend school?
Not attend school. So leaving with no qualifications, and then much later on as a young adult thinking I needed to go back into education, I just realised, and I didn't want my experiences to be that of children in schools, and I didn't want my experiences to be that for my own girls. I've got three girls. So going back into education to get my degree and my teacher qualification was really, really important to me. And it was when I was doing a night course that there was a black lecturer who said to me, you need to go back and get your GCSEs. Mm-hmm. So I saw somebody who looked like me. I saw somebody who took the time to say, go and do something. So that's kind of sat with me all those years. And then when I became a teacher, absolutely loved it. Teaching is a fabulous gig, don't get me wrong. Absolutely loved it. And then I realised that I wanted to make more of an impact. I wanted to be somebody who could make decisions that would affect thousands of young people, hence wanting to become a head teacher. Mm-hmm. I think I was pretty naive in that. I think I made an assumption that I'd done all this training, I was a great teacher, that actually going into leadership would be not a walk in the park, but it wouldn't be as challenging. I went for anything between 11 and 18 deputy head interviews, mm-hmm. often getting down to the final two, because that's how it works. They make a cut on day one, get down to the final two. And I just wasn't getting the jobs. And I just couldn't get my head around it.
And were you sure that was to do with race, or could other teachers with different ethnicities, be it white or whatever, apply for the same amount, perhaps getting down to the last two?
Well, when you get feedback along the lines of, we're just not sure how our community would relate to you, I think it's a lot
you
more.
You got that?
I got that.
What was your response to the people?
I was just shocked. You know, and sometimes you're so shocked that you really don't know how to respond. And so I just kind of thought, OK, I'll just keep going back until I get that job. And I did get a job, and I did get a substantive deputy head position. And, you know, again, like I say, working in education is an amazing, amazing experience. And I've only ever really worked in those kind of tough inner city schools that really need that help to kind of move them on. And I think the racism that really shocked me to my core, and actually shocks lots of people, is when I was working in a school, and a tough school, you have the standards, you really needed to improve standards, and I was holding a member of staff to account, and she was overheard referring to me as a frizzy-haired gollywog.
Now, that is a shocking statement, just for our listeners that are hearing that as well.
Yeah.
We're speaking about them because these were your experiences.
These are my lived experiences.
And we are hearing what you went through and the challenges that you feel are faced. This is an illustration of it. Did you confront that person?
I didn't confront that person directly, but what I did was, and I think this is the issue, the statement was bad enough in itself. And then when it was brought to the head teacher at the time, the response was not great, actually. And the head teacher felt that because I hadn't heard it directly, that there was nothing that could be done about it. And so that's an issue that we really need to address in schools, because some conversations are taking place. And actually, we as black people in education, we need to be listened to, and we need to be made to feel safe.
Some might say that there are laws on the books when it comes to speech or hate speech that should be counteracting some of what you're saying.
Yeah. Agreed. But who's holding everybody to account? And I think until we've got the Department for Education really shining a lens on our experiences, many of our experiences as black leaders can be swept under the carpet.
What is standing in the way?
What is standing in the way from?
In the sense of particularly black teachers getting to those leadership positions.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of unconscious bias. I think there is, when you look at senior leadership teams, and I say it in the book, when you look at a lot of senior leadership teams, they are predominantly white. Okay, it's neither healthy nor progressive. And therefore, you get stuck with the status quo. And there is something about being comfortable in those situations, is my view, that to actually then go out and actively recruit leaders from ethnically diverse backgrounds, I just think that there are some leadership teams that are just not ready for that.
How do you make them ready for it? Because I'm thinking, is this like an issue in society or within its educational establishments?
I would say it's in society, but actually, but my focus is education.
Of course.
Right?
And I'm just wondering like how you can ignite that change or make it happen if it's something that's reflecting society at large.
Well, first of all, let's acknowledge it. I think until people are ready to stand up and say, this is not okay, the fact that we've got 1% of head teachers who are black is not okay. So I think what we first need to do is acknowledge that it's a problem. I think secondly, we need to have a call for action. And the DfE don't have any targets around this. They don't have any targets around recruitment for black leaders.
Is that what you want?
I would love to see that. I would love to see. So when new teachers are beginning their training, let's have some racial literacy training, you know, because some of our new teachers are going in and look at our society today. We're more diverse than we've ever been. And actually, we need to equip our new teachers to be able to engage in these conversations.
What would that look like?
That would look like knowing how to have a conversation. Because
about race?
About race. It's difficult and some people shy away from it. And I always say it's okay to maybe not know the language, not know, you know, what's current at the moment, but at least try and let's just begin that conversation.
Evelyn Ford. And if you've been affected by any of the issues in the interview, there are links to support on the BBC Actionline website. A Department for Education spokesperson said, "We want teaching to be a supportive and inclusive profession and know how important it is that we attract and retain talented teachers from all backgrounds to deliver our mission to break down barriers to opportunity for all children. Issues around diversity, recruitment and retention have been neglected for too long. While the data shows things are improving gradually, we're working hard to recruit and support the progression of teachers from all backgrounds, including through our commitment to 6,500 more teachers in schools and colleges." And Emma Hollis, Chief Executive of the National Association of School-Based Teacher Trainers, or NASBTT, which represents school-based initial teacher training providers, said, "Lack of diversity in the teaching workforce is a persistent issue in the UK education system. In terms of overall recruitment, we know from the NFER research published this year that there is significant interest in teaching from black and minority ethnic candidates, but that this is not translating into more teachers from these communities standing in front of classes. NASBTT is working with a number of external partners, including diverse educators, to amplify the conversations around diverse representation in initial teacher training and in recruiting and retaining early career teachers. It's down to us and all ITT providers to ensure the teaching workforce is as diverse as the pupils they're teaching, which will help to drive aspiration, achievement and break down barriers." That's all from me, but you will not want to miss Monday's Woman's Hour. We speak to the actor Michelle Yeoh, best known for her Oscar-winning performance in Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. She joins Nuala, Lucky Nuala, to discuss her latest project, a film version of the musical Wicked. That's all from me. Have a lovely weekend.